Good evening, all. I'm K2, Romeo, India Whiskey. And my name is Dick. You'll also hear as a co-director, John, KC2WGB. John and Dick try to attempt to arrange this thing called the Technical Met, by which amateurs get together to discuss their favorite subject. John and I believe, as well as quite a few other people, that the majority of the purpose of the Technical Met is education. We teach each other this fairly complicated field of wireless technology. There are colleges where their professors tell their students that if you want to get a chance to see what radio is really like, the way it's being practiced in the real world, listen to the Technical Met. For a person who wants to listen to past Technical Mets, you can listen to the website of KC2NJI. He has a website at www.amateurradio.tangovictor. At that website, which has already had something like 200,000 hits, you'll hear past TechNet for the last 6.5 years. And most of them are, at least in the early years, documented as to what subject is being discussed during each 10 minutes. And by going to that website, you select the year, the month, the day, and then the hour, so to speak. There's four reels per the 4 hours of each typical TechNet, because each TechNet lasts approximately 4 hours. A person who has a real question or a comment and would like to make that comment or ask the question of this particular group gives John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. What we try to do on this TechNet, let me drop. We try to tap into that vast amount of brain power that exists in the New York City tri-state area. This particular repeater has moderately good coverage of northern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Connecticut, much of Long Island, and in that metro area there's a lot of brain power. So quite often what you'll hear as a person when all of us are struggling with a question, quite often someone with prior knowledge, with experience in that area, will chime in and give us the benefit of his experience. Okay, I guess it's time for that check-in. The way a typical check-in would sound would be the way Jim would check in, for instance. He would say, KC2WHY, Jim and yes, and he's a frequent sign-in. So give me your call letters and name and that word yes right now. K2LIW listening.
In 2EL, Rich and yes.
Hawaii.
Joe. Yes.
Hilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, John, yes.
N2 Meatball, with a yes. Good evening, Dick.
WS2N4, with a space report. Good evening, Dick.
N2XN, after Paul.
Okay, we had quite a few doubles that time. The first one I heard was Rich, N2EO, a couple of doubles, and then KC2BD, John, and N2 Moonbound. So in between Rich and John, who was that double?
Probably me.
Yeah, I did recognize the voice to be to RYY. Okay. We got Joe. Is there anyone else that we've missed so far?
WS1, I checked in after Moonbound. Paul with the space report.
Yeah, we heard you, Wes, and also Paul. We have more than enough to get going. Rich, N2EO, what's happening in Whitestone, Queens? K2RIW, you got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, good evening, N2EO. Give you an update. First, Barry N2MB's 6-meter kilowatt that I converted from an SB220 is 99% done, just waiting on an antenna transfer relay, and then we're going to build a little power supply in there to power that 12-volt relay, and that's the whole thing. We should be able to fire it up in about a week. I know mine, I'm getting 1,000 watts out on 6. In the meanwhile, Dick, I'm working on a Johnson Viking Ranger 2 that I'm doing some updates on. There were some updates to broaden out the frequency response and quite a bit of information on the Internet. Got a question concerning AM. Let me add a reset. understand, and my peak reading wattmeter bears this out, that under 100% modulation, you get four times the power output that you would get with just the carrier. So if you got 50 watts of carrier, you got 200 watts coming out of the transmitter under 100% modulation. I'm wondering how that actually works out. I'm trying to figure it out in my own mind, because to modulate, say, a 100-watt transmitter, you need 50 watts of audio. And how does that work out? Because I would think 100 watts of carrier, 50 watts of audio, it would show 25 watts in the upper and lower sideband. But I know that's not correct. So maybe you can explain that to me, Dick. The other thing I wanted to know is, what do they mean when they talk about Heising point modulation? H-E-I-S-I-N-G, Heising modulation. Back to you, Dick. H-O-R-I-W, Technam, IMARC, and 2EO.
That's a good question, Rich. There are lots of books and websites you can go to which will give you documentation. I got this thing set correctly. The fact that a 100-watt transmitter requires 50 watts of audio for high-level amplitude modulation. High-level modulation meaning that you're modulating the final stage. You're not modulating the drive to the final stage. Some people would call that low-level modulation. So whatever your carrier power is for an AM transmitter, 50% of that, at least, must be capable of being created by the amplitude modulator. The amplitude modulator is virtually in series with the power supply for the final stage. If your final tube had a, let me pick a number, 2,000 volt power supply, the 2,000 volts would flow through the secondary winding of an audio transformer properly designed for the service. The primary winding would be fed by, say for instance, a pair of push-pull audio tubes. You'd be generating something like 50 watts of audio for the 100 watt transmitter. During the time that the audio is running full 100% modulation, the winding of the secondary of the amplitude plate modulated transformer would double the voltage instantaneously for very short periods of time. Let me drop. If the tube was running 2,000 volts, for very short periods of time, there would be 4,000 volts on that tube. You would have twice the voltage. 2,000 volts would be continuously created by your 2,000 volt power supply, in my example, and another 2,000 volts of peak voltage would come out of the secondary winding. The secondary winding would be in series with the power supply, so instantaneously 4,000 volts would be on the plate of the tube. When you double the plate voltage on the tube, you're capable of also, if the tube is really running correctly, double the current it draws during that period of time. Twice voltage, twice current, multiply it together, four times the power. That's one way of looking at it. If you're putting voltage into a pure resistor, the power you put into the resistor is E squared over R, voltage squared divided by resistance. Once again, you double the voltage, you know that double squared is going to be 4, and 2 squared is 4. So that's another way of knowing that the peak envelope power will be 4 times greater. So for a very brief period of time, you're doing twice the voltage, 4 times the power. If you were looking on an oscilloscope at the voltage coming out of your transmitter going to the antenna, you would see during the time there's no modulation, let me pick a number, 100 volts going to the antenna. During the time that the peak modulation takes place, amplitude modulation, you'd see the 100 volts jump up to 200 volts for short periods of time and down to 0 volts for short periods of time. And there's the catch. The fact that those peak envelope powers are not continuous. The amplitude modulation is quadrupling the power for short periods of time, making the power go to zero for short periods of time. You average that all out. It turns out to be a 100-watt transmitter with full amplitude modulation, continuous sine wave. You whistle into the microphone with a 1KC note, continuous sine...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So once again, you've got this AM transmitter. It runs 100 watts output in my example. Before you modulate it, and you're going to see on your oscilloscope twice voltage for periods of time, zero voltage for periods of time. The average of that, if you average that whole envelope, your 100-watt transmitter would average to 150 watts. If you had a true RMS power meter, and you whistle into the microphone continuously a 1KC note, or put a 1KC audio generator into the microphone circuit, that'd be the exact way to do it with laboratory equipment. During the time it's got linear 100% amplitude modulation, your power output watt meter would go from 100 watts to 150 watts. Yes, a 100 watt transmitter does have 25 watts in the upper side lobe, 25 watts in the lower side lobe, when you look at it on spectrum analyzer. However, bear in mind that the upper side lobe of 50 watts, here we go now, 25 watts, 25 watts of the upper side lobe, 25 watts of the lower side lobe, those two side lobes are coherent. The side lobe voltage from the upper and lower, for short periods of time, those two voltages add together. How can 25 watts on the upper, 25 watts on the lower, 50 watts total as an average, how can that give you a peak of twice the voltage? By doing integration and a couple other experiments, you'd find that out. I know it doesn't sound like common sense, but by looking at the power, looking at the peak voltage, looking at it with an oscilloscope, looking at it with a spectrum analyzer, reading the right books, eventually you'll start making some sense. But what the average person forgets about is that during short periods of time, 0 watts comes out of that transmitter when it's 100% modulated. Adding that all together, it's a 50% increase, even though instantaneously, for short periods of time, it's 4 times the normal amount of carrier power.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I know this is not a completely comfortable answer to all of it, Rich, but as you go through it more and more, it'll start making a little bit more sense. And yeah, you haven't got the whole story, but at least you got a little few more pieces of the puzzle, if you know what I mean. N2EO, with enough delay in case anybody wants to sign in with EchoLink or IRLP, K2RIW. You've got it, Rich, with a little delay.
WVE3JIW, a quick comment request.
I think I heard VE3J something with a quick comment request. Start off with your name, sir, and go ahead with your comment request.
Thank you very much. My name is Jim, VE3JIW. I'm listening here. I know people in Toronto are listening, and we have a problem where sometimes the repeater times out every 5 minutes. Could you actually let it drop out for long enough for these things to pick back up? Other than that, I enjoy your net. Second week for me, VE3JIW, back to net.
VE3JIW, K2RIW. Okay, we're going to try to fulfill that. I know there's a continuous complaint, Jim, of all of us being excited about getting our turn to talk, and we jump the gun. We're supposed to wait for the 4 beeps, and some of us don't do it. I've just timed it out a couple of times myself, so to speak. So, okay, once every 5 minutes, we'll try to... I'll tell these guys to wait until the machine thoroughly drops before we pick up so that your machine up there can be reset. We'll try to do that, Jim. You got it, Rich. N2EO, I know you haven't got the whole story, but hopefully it'll make a little bit more sense. You got it, Rich.
Okay, but actually it makes more sense to me than maybe you realize. It points me in the right direction now to do some reading on it. Well, when you said the modulator, which I know, and it occurred to me, the modulation transformer is in series with the power supply, so you see voltage, it's two voltages in series, sort of like putting two batteries in a flashlight in series. And I guess the numbers on the sidebands, they add algebraically. When you talk about peak and average, I wonder if the number 0.637 comes up. Is peak times 0.636 or 637 times the peak power. I forget what formula I use that in, the one average voltage. And if you have time, maybe you want to do it next week, but I'd like to get a definition of Heising plate modulation, Dick.
Yeah, I'm not going to go through Heising right now until we've gone through all the list and make sure if we have some time left over, I'll give you some Heising. Now, when it comes to peak versus average versus RMS, there's a number of formulas that are used with a pure sine wave. If I've got a pure sine wave of 60 cycle power coming out of my ConEd or my Long Island Power Authority wall socket, which runs on average, it's supposed to run 120 volts RMS, root mean squared, a mathematical way of talking about the average heating power. If I got 120 volts coming out of my wall socket, and if I put it into a 120 ohm high power load resistor, I will, by definition, by Ohm's law, 120 volts RMS and 120 ohms real resistance, I will measure a current of 1 ampere, RMS 1 ampere. However, the peak voltage coming out of that wall socket, 120 volts RMS, happens to be around 167 volts. Square root of 2, 1.414, times 120 volts, that's the peak voltage that you get. If you were using a galvanometer, a Dawson valve movement, a normal meter movement, believe it or not, a normal meter movement, on average, a normal meter movement used in the normal way, does not measure peak voltage, does not measure RMS voltage, it measures average voltage. You go through the mathematics of 120 volts RMS and take 63% of that, you will get the average voltage that your meter would see of the 120. So there's lots of different ways of measuring things. But you got to know that the meter measures average, your oscilloscope measures peak, your RMS voltmeter measures RMS, and so on. About
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
I let it thoroughly drop that time. If I was using a an ideal diode rectifier, which has zero voltage drop, and with op-amp circuits I can come close to doing that, a real silicon diode is going to have a volt or two of drop, but if I was using an ideal diode rectifier into a capacitor, a so-called capacitor filter network, capacitor input filter network, and I connect it directly to the 120-volt line, I'll measure something like 167 volts, close to 167 volts, the peak voltage. Your oscilloscope will confirm to you that your ConEd power socket in your house is putting out something like 167 volts peak, even though your digital voltmeter or your volt-ohm milliammeter will tell you on the AC scale it's 120 volts RMS. But you got to be careful. That meter that you're using, your volt-ohm milliammeter, your triplet or your Simpson, it really measured average, but they recalibrated the scale with the 63% correction factor so that the meter reading an average of 63% of 120 volts, the scale will tell you it's 120. That's not what the meter really said. The reason I say that that's important is that the 63% average jazz into the ordinary meter movement is true for a sine wave and only a sine wave. That exact same meter measuring a square wave or a step square wave or whatever will measure something else. And you'd be amazed how many people fall into traps on that one. I'm just giving you a thumbnail sketch of this jazz that you're getting into, Rich. And it's a beautiful subject, but we're going to have to take it in pieces. Bye-bye for now, and I'm going to go on to Rich. Here we go. W-H-R-Y-Y. Joe. Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y. Wait long enough for three beeps, and then go ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, it takes a little longer than that, by about 3 or 4 seconds, for you to release a delay on the internet, because if I'm ganging up on that, you'll time yourself off the reflector. And of course, the other people are timing out off the reflector. And that's what the guy was talking about. Anyway, good evening to you. My comment is, this is about a subject that I brought up about 2 or 3 weeks ago, about one of those tunable loops that goes around something like a broadcast radio to enhance it. I did some measurements at work, and one of the guys who built one of these things, which is built to be mimicking a select antenna, he says this is a copy of it basically, I used a small rubber ducky antenna and was able to actually get some readings of what this does as far as enhancement with a signal level on a spectrum analyzer. Back to you.
Hey, you've given us a bit of a tease there. And this is one of the places where I occasionally tell people that no engineer worth his salt will run around with his nose in the air and an elitist attitude, assuming that he never makes a mistake, and anybody accusing him of making a mistake must be wrong. Every engineer, every scientist, every human being has a batting average. None of us, to put it in baseball terms, bats 1,000. We all make a certain error rate. And the error I made was to assume that when you build a loopstick-like antenna, which is an infinitesimal antenna as far as wavelengths are concerned, the loopstick or a whip antenna or anything else that you and I build at AM broadcast frequencies, 1 megacycle approximately, where the wavelength is 300 meters, a 1,000-foot wavelength, and none of us are going to put up a 1,000-foot antenna, so to speak, or 500-foot antenna to get reception there. So when you've got a infinitesimal dipole-like antenna, you only lose half a decibel in the ideal world, half a decibel compared to a full half-wave dipole at the right altitude. As you make the antenna smaller and smaller and smaller, you don't lose any more than half a dB. But I did say it, but I didn't believe it at first, that the catch is, if you're using a lossless matching network, you've used loading coils and zigzagging of the wire and top hat capacitors, all the things to physically make the antenna smaller. Let me drop. And you've also used an ideal antenna tuner. As long as you're using a lossless network, shrinking the antenna down, common sense would lead you to believe it's got a smaller and smaller effective capture area, and it's going to get less and less signal. Good common sense, dead wrong. Because the Q increases, because the circulating currents within the antenna, whether it's transmitting or receiving, the circulating currents within the antenna get stronger and stronger for the same amount of voltage being applied. When the antenna becomes smaller and smaller because of the increase in Q. The good news is the Q increases. The bad news is the increase of the Q makes it a very narrow band antenna. If you SY 10KC, you got to retune it, so to speak. But because of that increase in Q and the expanding magnetic field around it, the effective capture area within half a dB stays the same, if and only if it's lossless. And as John and others, KD2BD, starting to tell me about this, you really have quite a bit of loss in that tiny little loop stand antenna. If I took that ideal dipole that I shrunk down in size, and I match it losslessly, and I measure its real performance, and then I put a shunt resistor across it, or a series resistor in series with it, to start increasing the losses, now I'm going to lose effective capture area. Now I'm going to lose gain. I'm going to get less signal. In some circumstances, you might hear a signal that sounds almost the same because you're getting less atmospheric noise and less signal. The signal-to-noise ratio might stay the same, but the signal strength meter, your S meter, is not going to deflect the same. And so we're slowly discovering our corrections on that one, Joe. Sounds to me like you've made a measurement, and tell me what you saw. For B2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, what I did was I was using a service monitor set up with spectrum analyzer mode, bandwidth about 20 kilohertz, 20 kilohertz per division. So looking at about maybe a quarter meg across the whole screen with so many divisions, all right? Looking at a frequency of where the word QTH, looking at, say, 10-10 winds, which is at 10-10 kilohertz. And I was using a type of pickup antenna that was part rubber duck, part telescopic metal antenna. So I don't know really how well this thing resonates in the broadcast band. It actually seemed to get stronger than I actually put my hand on the antenna itself. But say, with whatever signal was picking up by itself, I was holding the coax cables near the bottom of the antenna. As I put this antenna within the loop and tuned the loop to resonance, the signal level come up 15 to 20 decibels in signal strength. Back to you.
And you're confirming what Joe was telling us last week, John, KD2BD. that when you build one of these large, low loss resonators, which now gives you the effector capture area, and because it is a high Q circuit, it has by definition a large circulating magnetic field around it when a signal is present, and therefore when you place it near your loop stick or whatever you're using as an antenna, you couple to it and you get the benefit of it. The overall antenna circuit as a composite of the two, the original one plus the one you're adding, the Q is increasing, the efficiency is increasing, the effective capture area is increasing, not because of the size. You would be led to believe that this thing that you're adding, because it's bigger in size, you're picking up more signal. Good common sense. It's left-handed. Because it's bigger in size, it's made out of better material, thicker, wider, and more ferrite and whatever, and as such, it has less loss. The bigger size has less loss, higher Q. That's where the benefit is coming from. So you saw a 15 or 20 decibels improvement, and I think that's what John has been seeing also. John is possibly, if he had a chance this week, he was going to, for us, make a bandwidth measurement. In other words, he was going to measure the half-power bandwidth of his loop stick, half-power bandwidth of his great big ferrite device that's external, or his wider device that's external, and also get a confirmation along those lines. Let me drop for a second something else I wanted to say. And that is, you've got a fairly strong piece of evidence there, Joe, that when you put your hand on your little antenna and the signal strength increased, that's pretty strong evidence that it either wasn't quite in resonance to begin with, or the increased performance of your body as an extender, as a length extender to the antenna, was improving its performance. A normal antenna properly tuned, where there's real tracking between the RF amplifier stage and the rest of the radio, you put your hand on that antenna, you would be detuning it, and the signal would normally decrease. The fact that you saw an increase means that either it had so darn much loss that it had so much the signal being turned into heat in that loss, and your hand acting as an extension to the whip antenna, to the rubber duck, was increasing it. The fact that it got stronger instead of weaker tells us that it wasn't an ideal antenna to begin with, which is sort of what you knew, but now you're getting laboratory confirmation of that. Back to you, Joe, for some more comments, and then we're going to go over to John, and if he's had a chance to make that measurement, I think we're going to get another earful here. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, the other interesting thing I noticed was actually the noise floor on the bottom of the analyzer actually increased, and you could, as you tune the frequency of this loop, you could actually watch that noise floor go and come towards and actually go past, say, 1010 Winston's frequency. And when, of course, when you hit the resonance of this loop on 1010, you saw the signal go up 15 to 20 decibels. But it brought actually the noise level of the analyzer, like a little, it looked like a spurious emission almost going across the screen, back and forth, as you change the resonance higher and lower frequency. Back to you.
I'm very glad you recognize that, Joe. Another important issue here. One of the big mysteries that's happened to us on a number of occasions, somebody will sign in and say, how come I can take my ordinary ham radio receiver, tune it to, say, for instance, the 80-meter band, pick up a random hunk of wire that's laying on the table, take that random hunk of wire, skin one end of it, plug it into the center conductor of the UHF connector on the back of the receiver, and start hearing 80-meter signals, and they sound beautiful. How can I do that? That's not a resonant antenna. I didn't tune it. If I try transmitting into it, nothing happens. Nobody's going to hear me except the guy next door. I can't transmit into it, and yet I can receive so well. That appears to be a violation of reciprocity. If I did that on 432, I would get nowhere near that kind of performance. How can I do that on 80 meters? And the answer is, your space noise, your galactic noise, your ionospheric noise, the total amount of noise you've got on HF frequencies, like 80 meters and one megacycle and so on, those two different bands, the total amount of atmospheric noise is approximately equal to a 40 or a 50 decibel noise figure. So there's a whole lot of noise coming in the antenna. As you tune an antenna to resonance, you're resonating in such a way that it can pick up the noise as well as the signal. And so you can have an antenna that is, let me pick a number, 30 decibels inefficient. it is getting 0.1% of the normal amount of receiver power because it's a random length of wire you picked up off the table and plugged into the semiconductor. Let me drop. So that random hunk of wire, in my example, could be 30 decibels inefficient because the noise on the band is 40 decibels louder than KTV, the noise of a 50-ohm resistor, properly impedance matched at room temperature. That's what KTB really means. Boltzmann's constant times temperature times bandwidth. You calculate all that and you figure out there's a certain amount of noise that should be there. And the noise coming into your antenna on HF frequencies is approximately 40 decibels louder. Your 30 decibel inefficient antenna has subtracted 30 of the 40 dB excess. You've now only got 10 dB of excess noise. You've attenuated the noise by 30 dB. You've attenuated the signal you want to listen to by 30 dB, but the signal-to-noise ratio stayed the same. So on HF frequencies, that random hunk of wire is almost good enough for receiving only. Don't transmit into it, because now the 30 decibels of inefficiency is there, and the guy is not going to hear you. By corresponding experiment, you do that at the 432 megacycle band, or the 450 meg band, where the noise in that band is, one or two decibels of noise, figure with a noise, and you make yourself an inefficient antenna that's 30 decibels inefficient, you're now not going to hear noise because it was just barely hearable to begin with a super low noise preamplifier, and you attenuate that signal, which is weak to begin with on a 450 band, you attenuate that signal by 30 dB and forget it. Again, if the guy's not next door to you, you're not going to hear it. So it sounds at first like violation of reciprocity. There's some darn good physics here. And by the way, there's a good way of, let me drop. There's many a regenerative-like circuit viewed on, say, for instance, a spectrum analyzer, that as you tune the tuning of the circuit, you'll see a burst of noise, which frequency-wise has got a Gaussian shape to it, if you know what I mean, and you'll see the central frequency of that noise drift up and down on the screen of the spectrum analyzer as you tune that circuit. And that's what you've observed. Glad you caught all that. Let's see what John's got to say. Hopefully, John's had a chance to make some of these measurements. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. Tell us what's going on in Seagirt. K2LAW, you got it, John.
Good evening, Dick. K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD. Well, last week we spoke about loop antennas, and you suggested I do some Q measurements. And so I did that. I found the loop stick that I was using has a Q of 37, bandwidth of 20 kilohertz. This was done sort of in the middle of the band, around 924 kilohertz. My 10-turn external loop has a Q of 90 and a bandwidth of 10 kilohertz. So I did some more measurements and I did some more calculations, and this is what I found. I have an equation that provides for me the output voltage of a loop antenna, of an electrically small loop, I should say, given the wavelength, the field strength, the number of turns in the loop, and the area of the loop. So I took the measurement, and knowing the Q also is important in this equation. So knowing what measurement I took, for example, on WCBS, 880 kilohertz, measuring that output voltage, plugging in the numbers into the equation, I came up with a field strength in my area of 3.17 millivolts per meter. Let me let it drop. Okay. Out of my 10-turn loop, I received 21.2 millivolts RMS carrier from WCBS. And so I said, okay, well, how does this relate to the efficiency of a dipole? Well, there's another equation. Now that I know approximately what the field strength of that signal is that I'm looking at, there's another equation that knowing the field strength will give me the voltage across a dipole into its properly terminated load. So I took the 3.17 millivolt per meter field strength, plugged that into the equation, assumed an impedance of a halfway dipole of 70 ohms, went through the calculations and calculated that a 70-ohm dipole should produce 168 millivolt signal. Now, looking at the 10-turn loop output versus the dipole, it looks like the 10 terminal loop is 18 dB below the voltage output of a dipole, or 12.58% efficiency. My loop stick, therefore, is minus 48 dB below a dipole, or 0.4% efficiency. Now, Krauss's example in his book uses 0.06% efficiency in his example. How do you like those numbers? K2RAW from KD2BD.
Fantastic. By the way, when you say dipole should have been 168 millivolts, I think that's a calculation. That's a calculation for a half-wave dipole, which would be 500 feet long or something like that at 1 megacycle, at 880 kilohertz. It would be a hell of a lot even bigger yet. And again, that's an assumption that the dipole itself and its impedance-matching network is 100% efficient. Okay, you saw... I'm a little bit disappointed that the 10-turn... Let's see now. You had the loop stick had a Q of 37. Your external circuit had a Q of 90. That's a hell of an increase. I expect it to be a little bit greater than that. You made a rough guess that the ferrite loop stick in the radio is minus 48 dB. And now I'm starting to see something. On the assumption that's right, and it might very well be, if the noise on the band is a 40 decibel excess noise figure, and your ferrite loop antenna that's normally built into it by the manufacturer is minus 48 dB in efficiency, 8 dB lower than the noise figure, and on the assumption your receiver had a 0 dB noise figure, which it doesn't, your receiver noise figure might be, let me pick a number, 6 dB. 6 dB noise figure, 48 dB of inefficiency is 54 dB of total inefficiency on a 40 dB space noise system. You're 14 dB below hearing the noise of Mother Nature, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. If these numbers are accurate, you and I are eventually going to confirm some of this as time goes on, John, 54 dB of inefficiency on 40 dB of TXS means that you're 14 dB below, in my rough calculation, being able to hear space noise. See, ordinarily, an inefficient antenna on HF frequencies doesn't hurt you because you're cutting back the noise and the signal by the same amount when you're receiving, not transmitting. But if the amount you're cutting it back is greater than the amount of excess noise, and now you're hurting real sensitivity because you can't go negative dB on picking up noise, but you can certainly go down a lot of dB when it comes to picking up the signal, and therefore you lose it. And you add this external circuit to your AM radio, which picks you up out of that condition by X number of dB, you're now, for the first time, able to hear the real background noise of Mother Nature. In the meantime, your signal you're picking up is getting stronger. Your S meter is going up. Good things are happening. So in all cases, what we're trying to do at HF frequencies is cure the inefficiency due to resistive loss, the equivalent of resistive loss, whether it be the loss tangent of the ferrite material or the resistance of the wiring or whatever. And so, interesting experiment. So let me drop... As you guys can see, I've been considerably humbled by this. So often I've given this little talk about the random hunk of wire doing a beautiful job with HF receiving, and all of a sudden people come along with these great big circuits, and what I thought was a great big fancy advertising claim of manufacturers selling you these boosters for AM signals, and now I am a believer, John. You've convinced me, and the kind of measurements you're making is starting to now. You're slowly getting traceability to the Bureau of Standards as to what really is going on here. So it's the efficiency improvement that is making the effective capture area go up. An infinitesimal dipole doesn't lose effective capture area when compared to a half-wave dipole if the materials have 100% efficiency. So good stuff, John. Back to you. KD2BD, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Very good. K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2BD. Yeah, the noise level is very high at these frequencies, but the signals that we're receiving are very strong as well. So a low-efficiency antenna isn't that bad of a deal, especially if you could fit it into such a tiny little, receiver configuration. And the Q of that loop stick is kind of important, too, because these receivers are made so cheaply that that's all the front-end selectivity there is.
So that's providing you, all the image rejection possible in the receivers, because generally there is no RF amplifier. It's just that loop stick feeding a converter, which is an oscillator mixer combination. I'm getting approximately 30 decibels of improvement, coupling the external loop up to a small loop stick that's about 2.5 or so inches long. I did one other last calculation, and that was I wanted to look at the effective capture of a dipole versus the ferrite loop stick. And at 880 kilohertz, half-wave dipole has an effective capture area of 15,175.5 square meters. With the calculated negative 48 dB inefficiency of the loop stick compared to a dipole, that effective capture area is down to 240.6 square millimeters. Wow. K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
What a ratio. You guys have heard me say so many times that a good half-wave dipole on 80 meters, 132-foot long piece of wire. At high noon, that piece of wire is casting a shadow on the ground. If you make it out of 14-gauge household wire, as many of us do, it's casting a shadow on the ground about a square foot. Radio-wise, at resonance, that half-wave dipole, an 8-inch diameter piece of wire, 132 feet long, has 8,500 square feet of effective capture area. Hard to believe, it really does. Now let me show you a contrast going on here. John, you and I are, let me pick a number, 100 miles apart, 80 miles apart. I could transmit a 10-watt or a 20-watt signal into a Yagi antenna on 2 meters, and you over there in Seagirt are going to hear me gangbusters. I could transmit the same amount of power into my 80-meter dipole, and you over there in Seagirt at high noon will not hear me. And you can easily say, well, the signal doesn't bend correctly right, HF behaves differently. I'm going to zoom back. As far as I'm concerned, that electromagnetic wave at 80 meters that I'm trying to send to you over there, the electromagnetic wave I'm trying to send to you on 2 meters, it's a slight difference in frequency, a hell of a difference in wavelength, but it's the same electromagnetic wave. It gets there. The catch is, what is it competing with? On 2 meters, it's competing with amount of band noise that's a couple of dB above KTB. On 80 meters, you're competing with a band noise that's 40 decibels of equivalent noise figure. Until I get the help of the ionosphere, you don't hear me. And so it isn't because the signal didn't get there. It's because it is being competing with so darn much other noise. So an awful lot of us, of how we think signals do and don't go, are being colored by us not realizing how much noise the signal is competing with.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So once again, an 80 meter, let me drop it. So that a half-wave dipole, if you did really build one at 880 kilohertz, 15,000 square meters, and because it's a function of frequency squared, and I use 3.5 megacycles, and I come up with 8,500 square feet. It sounds like it's the right ballpark. I'm beginning to believe. But I know darn well you didn't build a full half-wave, 100% efficient dipole at 880 kilohertz. In theory, you could. The quarter-wave ground plane that a broadcast station uses with a couple of miles of wire in the ground as the counterpoise, making sure the ground has proper conductivity. They are building a resonant structure, a full quarter-wave resonant structure or so, at that broadcast station. They do that. And if you went out and measured their effective capture area, I think it would be in the vicinity of 18,000 square meters. Crazy numbers, aren't they, John? KD2BD, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, K2RAW on the TechNet from KD2BD. I was just amazed by that loopstick capture area of being only 240 square millimeters. But there's a heck of a lot of loss in that loopstick. I did a couple other small calculations and measurements. I found that within the loopstick itself, there's an AC resistance in the coil of 104 ohms, which is kind of high. And my 10-turn loop is made with number 28 gauge wire. It's not very thick wire at all.
I was at a computer festival once, and out at the flea market, and there was this guy with a tent just giving away stuff. He saw me walking by, and he had a reel of alpha 10-conductor ribbon cables. He says, "You want this? Take it." So I took it, and I didn't use it for a couple of years until this loop antenna idea came about. That has an NAC resistance of 15.6 ohms. And I imagine with much better conducting wire, that would have a lot less resistance. And I used the same variable capacitor in both cases, and I didn't measure the Q of the capacitor. I'm assuming it's fairly high. I'm assuming it's higher than the coils that I measured. But I didn't take that loss into any consideration. And you're correct. I did not build a half-wave dipole for 880 kilohertz, but I computed what the voltage across the dipole would be properly terminated. Now there's another catch. The dipole will actually produce an output power level. It produces voltage and it produces current. A loop antenna, depending on how you're feeding it, will only give you voltage or will only give you current. It's not a power device, so you have to use buffering circuits if you want a low impedance output or a transformer, you know, a single turn loop within the 10 turn loop to get a low impedance output. K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Your timing was perfect, John. A fraction of 1 second got lost at the end of your transmission as the machine timed out. The Q, one of the things that I sometimes ask people, and what's really sad, is I can take a person, you know, from a major company, I won't mention which one, who is in charge of the antenna development department, and under his tutelage is five or six antenna engineers, three or four anechoic chambers, lots of patents, lots of history, 15, 20 years in the business. I mean, this is a real antenna engineer, the guy who teaches the course in a school, okay? I asked him a fairly simple sounding question, and you can have a lot of fun with your friends on this one. And here it goes. Let me drop. I said I've got an ideal half-wave dipole at some frequency. Don't worry about the frequency. Believe me that the center impedance of that dipole is 72 ohms resistive. I'm feeding it with 72 ohm twin lead cable. I'm using a balanced signal generator with 72 ohms for the output. I'm now doing a Gedanken experiment. That signal has been continuously pouring out of the signal generator. This is a steady state experiment. The signal's been going down that cable into that antenna continuously for the last 10 minutes. I'm now watching wave number 5,041,000, so to speak, coming out of the signal generator. I watch it travel down the twin lead cable in this Gedanken experiment. I've slowed down time. I've got the right kind of instrumentation. I've got visualization of that wave, of wave number 10,000,000 and something. I've watched this particular wave come out of the signal generator. I've watched it go down the twin lead of cable. I know it's going down the 72-ohm cable. I know that the cable is being terminated at the end with what the cable thinks is a 72-ohm pure resistor called dipole at resonance running steady state. Therefore, there is no reflection in the cable. The signal goes down the cable once and only once, doesn't come back. One-to-one standing wave ratio by definition. I watch the power or the charge or the voltage, call whatever units you want, joules of energy, whatever. I watch the energy leave the end of the 72-ohm cable and to begin to progress down the wire of the dipole. I said to him, "Tell me what happened next." And he looked at me in a funny way. I'd done this experiment three or four times with three or four real solid antenna engineers. I then asked him, "What happens next?" And they start giving you innocuous sounding answers. It radiates. "Oh, tell me about that. Are you telling me the signal just jumps off the wire into..."
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I guess there's a signal after it leaves the twin lead and enters the wire of the dipole of the antenna. Does the signal just jump into space, radiate into space? And they say, no. They start discussing boundary conditions, Maxwell's equations, impedances, Qs. They start discussing all kinds of things, and I said, what really happens? And they eventually will admit to me, no one's ever asked me that question. Why should we consider that? Why should you consider it? It's damn important. You don't care how it radiates. And then many of them think that the signal, once the antenna is properly resonated, they really believe the signal goes down the wire once, and in the process it radiates into space. In which case I say, if the energy all radiates into space as it progresses down the wire, therefore there's no energy left over when it gets down to the end of the wire, the far insulator away from the center of the dipole. If that's true, if there's no energy left, therefore I can add an extra chunk of wire out there and nothing will happen, right? I say, no. Or I say, okay, what's really happening then? That extra length of wire knocks it out of resonance. What does that mean? Or he means when the signal goes down the center of the, when it leaves the twin lead and gets around the insulator in the center of the dipole and starts entering the wire, by some magic it knows how long the length of that wire is and knows whether or not at that point it should start presenting a inductive reactance because I've added some extra length to that wire. And that, you can tell that they really didn't figure out what's going on. The bottom line, when you think about it far enough, is the signal does not jump into space. Radiation is damn hard. Let me drop. On average, something like a couple of percent of that signal radiates into space on the first pass. The signal must bounce back and forth on that dipole something like 20 times before the majority of the signal finally gets radiated into space. What we call resonance is setting up the electrical performance of the antenna. Sometimes it's a physical length, or the physical length with the extra inductors and capacitors and top hats. We make the electrical length of the antenna halfway resonant so that the signal can bounce back and forth 20 times and stay co-phase, stay in step. Because it's got to stay in step, it's got to be bouncing back and forth in phase for radiation to really take place. None of the books say that, but that's the bedrock of what's really happening with our antennas. The bottom line of that, the most important part of that, is you resonate first, then you can radiate. On average, with the antennas that we use, our so-called standing wave antennas, we call it a standing wave antenna, we hear those words, we don't recognize what the hell it really means. Standing wave means the signal is bouncing back and forth many times. If the antenna's got a Q of 37, your loop antenna, that signal, rough rule of thumb, that signal has to bounce back and forth 37 times before it can radiate if you are transmitting. And because of reciprocity, it's bouncing back and forth 37 times in order to resonate when you're receiving before it finally gets into the rest of the radio. If that signal has to bounce back and forth 37 times in your loop stick, and if that loop stick has 104 ohms of resistance, and for all we know, that's a 10 ohm antenna, as far as its real electrical performance is concerned, but it's got 104 ohms of resistance, and the signal's being attenuated 37 times by going through that 104 ohm resistor, you can see what's happening here, where the inefficiency is happening. Let me drop. If you and I set up an inductor and a capacitor, because we're doing a grid dip meter measurement on the desk, and we're doing it at a VHF frequency, and we set up a certain number of turns of wire, nice and thick diameter, put a high value, high quality capacitor across it, and with the grid dip meter, you get a very nice dip out of the thing. The wire of that particular resonator that I just described probably has a few milliohms of resistance. The equivalent series resistance of the capacitor is a fraction of an ohm, and the signal can bounce back and forth in there a whole lot of times and give you a high Q. And here we are with a circuit with 104 ohms of resistance. I'm beginning to see where it's happening. Some of it is in the ferrite itself, its loss tangent. A lot of it is in the wire. I suspect there are ways of building a higher performance loopstick antenna if you want to be able to sell a pocket transistor radio that a person stands a chance of doing AM radio DXing. I think you're onto something here, John. I think there are ways of making the radio better. I mean, to get rid of 104 ohms of resistance wouldn't cost a whole lot of bucks. But for the guy that's doing AM radio DXing, boy, you and I would buy that in an instant. I think there's a fortune to be made here, John. KD2BD, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K
K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Well, the lipstick that I worked with has wire that's like a human hair thin. And I've seen other lipsticks that use lips wire, so I'm guessing that would probably, they're doing that probably to try to minimize those losses. The old All-American 5 tube receivers, the back of those radios had not a loop stick, but an open core loop built into the back of the receiver, and that was a much better approach, I think, to AM radio reception, because that receiver only used one IF stage. But there's another way of eliminating all this resistance, and it's fairly simple, and that is, instead of feeding the loop stick directly into a converter in an AM radio, feed it into an RF amplifier and apply a small amount of regeneration back to the loop stick, and you'll be able to tune out a lot of that loss. The only thing is, you have to be careful now that you don't start decreasing your receiver bandwidth. So that may not work out so well. You might get very muffled audio if you do try that. K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried here. I could build my 80-meter dipole in a normal manner. I could distribute resistors along the wire, break the wire and put in resistors. I could make the dipole inefficient. That's easy. To kill the performance of a dipole, there's a zillion ways I can do it. The pure way to do it would be to make it out of nichrome wire, if you know what I mean. I can add a lot of distributed resistance in that wire. Then, if after the dipole I just described made out of nichrome, I now add a real high-quality amplifier, and I try to get back the signal that I lost in the dipole. As far as amplification is concerned, I can get the signal back. Can I really get the performance back of a real dipole? I'm worried. I mean, you and I know, John, that if you kill the signal before the first stage of amplification, and the signal is now below the noise of your amplification stage, no matter how much gain you add downrange, you ain't going to get that signal back. You're going to be adding signal and noise simultaneously, if you know what I mean. So I'm a little worried about the way antennas behave. They're a little bit peculiar. They're trying to make a good impedance match to the ether, the free space. And if you lose it at that interface, can you, by super regen techniques or by regenerative techniques, you can increase the gain of the system, but can you correct for the inefficiency you've created at that point? I'm a little worried. When you make this great big high Q network nearby your loopstick antenna, you're now addressing the way the signal receives from Mother Nature. But to do it electronically downrange, maybe yes, maybe no. There's another whole series of questions there. Back to you for a final, John. I'm going to have to move on, but you're onto a fascinating subject. What a scientific experiment you're doing here. KD2BD, K2RIW.
Well, I agree. Once the signal is lost, it's lost. But at low frequencies, the noise level is so high and the signal levels are so high that you could probably get away with a little regeneration. I've seen some circuits of loops and loop preamps, some of which have a regeneration control to try to narrow the bandwidth and try to electronically, as a negative resistance effect, cancel out some of that resistance and bring up the gain and narrow down the bandwidth. So the performance of the antenna and the preamp combination looks as though you have a more efficient antenna. But I agree, that preamp is going to be adding noise, and if the atmospheric noise is low enough, then it's going to present a problem. K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Very fine, John. Be looking forward to your report next week as that series of experiments progresses.
Just a question.
Go ahead, Wes.
If I understand correctly, could we have a scenario in which the antenna represents the resistance of 200 ohms, say, but then the impedance is, let's say, 5 ohms or 10 ohms?
Yeah, when you make that real good dipole on 80 meters, in my example, which has a 72-ohm impedance at its center, and if I do a real good job of the right kind of wire, the right diameter of wire, and including the skin effect that only the first 10,000th of an inch of the outer layer of the wire is doing all the work. Even if I include the skin effect, that wire dipole on 80 meters in my example might have 4 ohms of total resistance. But it's a 72-ohm structure. 4 ohms versus 72 ohms probably means I have, let me pick a number, 92% efficiency as far as my ability to convey the signal the dipole picks up from free space into the rest of my circuitry. I'm losing a couple of percent of it because of the 4 ohms of my example, but it's a 72-ohm impedance antenna. Conversely, I can easily see a situation where the impedance of the antenna is, because of the way it's being used, 10 ohms, but the resistance within the antenna that you measure with an ohm meter is 104 ohms, which is John's example. And then if I now measure the resistance electronically at the operating frequency, where I'm now using the skin effect of the wire, the loss tangent, the ferrite, and whatever, the equivalent series resistance might be, let me pick a number, 500 ohms. If I've got 500 ohms of loss resistance in my antenna, and the antenna is a 20-ohm impedance, that efficiency is really yucky, really terrible, and that's somewhat like what I think John is measuring. And we're now starting to see some of the mechanism of that. Now, they've got to use lip wire in order to not have eddy current effects within the wire. But I still think there's ways of getting around this. And right now, the ways of getting around it are going to... Let me drop. It's going to slightly increase the cost of this inexpensive AM radio. The inexpensive AM radio is a highly competitive market. If it costs an extra dollar, I might not be able to sell it, if you know what I mean.